Focus. Next week, we'll be rerunning the interview I did last month with Portland City Commissioner Joanne Hardesty. It was on the wrong time last month, but this time it'll be on at 10 o'clock. It's normal. My engineer is Patsy Kohlberg. I'm Barbara Bernstein. We're going to go out with some music by Van Morrison. Thanks for listening.
Thanks, Barbara.
Thanks, Barbara.
When all the dark clouds roll away, young sun begins to shine.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud sponsor of the Clinton Street Resistance Series every Monday night at the Clinton Street Theater. Monday, March 18th, Clinton Street Resistance will screen Dogma. This screening benefits Not Okay PDX. Again, that's Dogma showing Monday, March 18th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Hello, this is Susan Cecil, and I love KBOO. Do you love KBOO? Call us at 503-231-8032, extension 302, and tell us why you love KBOO. We'll use the audio during our upcoming spring membership drive. It takes the community to support the community radio station, KBOO! Yay! The number again, 503-231-8032, extension 302. This has been Susan Cecil for KBOO Portland, signing out. Bye!
And good morning. You are tuned to KBOO Portland, and the time now is just a minute after 11 o'clock. All of this KBOO programming is made possible by members' support. To become a member, go to kboo.fm and click on the button marked Donate. And now, stay tuned for Beloved Community. Hugh Turley returns to discuss his work uncovering the mystery of Thomas Merton's death, December 10th, 1968, in Bangkok, Thailand.
The aftermath of nonviolence is the creation of the beloved community. The aftermath of nonviolence is redemption. The aftermath of nonviolence is reconciliation. The aftermath of violence, however, is bitterness. And this is the thing I'm concerned about. Let us fight passionately and unrelentingly for the goal of justice and freedom. But let's be sure that our hands are clean in the struggle. Let us never fight with falsehood and violence and hate and malice, but always fight with love, so that when the day comes that the walls of segregation have completely crumbled in Montgomery, that we will be able to live with people as our brothers and sisters.
Good morning. This is KBOO Portland, the Beloved Community. My name is John Shuck. Normally, the Beloved Community is heard on the second Friday of each month at 9 in the morning, but this past schedule in March, it was International Women's Day, and so all of the programming at KBOO was hosted by women, and so we moved this program just today for this month to the 11 o'clock Monday morning hour. Back in April, back to 9 a.m. On the second Friday, I think it's April 12th. So, the Beloved Community talks about spirituality, social justice, some issues you're not supposed to talk about. This is March 2019. In March 2018, one of my guests was not allowed to be on my show. I had Kevin Barrett scheduled. He is and I thought I'd give you an update on what the story is on that. Kevin Barrett is an expert on false flags and Islamophobia. He's an academic doctor of of Arabic studies and Islam. He's a Muslim. And we were going to talk about the false flag of 9/11 and the Islamophobia and the wars of terror that have been unleashed in the Middle East since then. Important topics. But just before it aired, Kevin Barrett was the target of a smear campaign led by Rose City Antifa with typical lies. that Dr. Barrett is an anti-Semite and Holocaust denier and a conspiracy theorist and all other name-calling kinds of things, typical smears against those who criticize Israel. The KABU staff and management canceled Dr. Barrett's appearance. I made an appeal then, and it is still in progress after a year. I wanted, fundamentally, Dr. Barrett to be able to defend himself against these attacks. I also want hosts to be able to select their guests and not be censored by staff. But since I was a board member of the foundation board, I, you know, didn't aggressively pursue all of this stuff. I carefully went through the process. Last summer, I spoke with the board president, Reuben Lawrence, and vice president Danielle Parks about the case. They were going to talk it over with the management, but they didn't get to that. The manager left in January. I wrote an email to Reuben and Danielle regarding the process, and I received back that they are very busy. Reuben and Danielle are now acting as station managers, and they listed all the things that they're going on at KABU, and they finally said at the end, anything that isn't related to the basic functioning of the station will not be looked at for several months. So I'd ask that you check in the first few months of our fiscal 2020, which begins in October. Hopefully things will be in better shape by then. So we have a rather slow conflict resolution process here at KABU. It's already been 12 months. October 2019 will be 19 months after the event. Nonetheless, I abide. But let me tell you what I really think about the issue. I've written this to KABU before. I think it has merit. I'll leave it with you. I think there should be clarification at KABU regarding all programming decisions. It seems logical to me that KABU staff and management should trust hosts in terms of producing shows that conform to FCC guidelines and KABU's program charter. If a complaint is made about a show after it has aired and staff think the complaint has possible merit, then the staff should talk to the host first and then bring the complaint to the program advisory committee for evaluation and advice on how to proceed after it has aired, not about stuff before it has aired. I think there should be educational shows analyzing the Israel lobby, smear campaigns, accusations of anti-Semitism, white supremacy, conspiracy theories, Holocaust denial. What do these terms even mean? And in what sense do they have validity? And in what sense are they just name-calling and character assassination in order to ban and censor unpopular political views? I think there should be programming at KBOO, more of it, regarding 9/11 research, state crimes against democracy, the so-called global war on terror, and Islamophobia. I'd be happy to host a show on those topics or be part of a collective, bringing important voices to the conversation, such as Dr. Barrett's and others, and to hear voices others bring. And finally, and this is just human decency, whether people are guests, hosts, volunteers, members, or whoever, it seems consistent with a beloved community that if someone wants to accuse someone of doing something bad, then that person should be allowed to defend herself or himself in front of the accuser before a judgment is made about that person. Just giving you an update of where I am. Like the dude, I abide. Happy to be here. Kevin Barrett is, in a sense, a ghost in the machine here. But I am about ending the war, so I have a final statement that I will give. The first casualty of war is truth. We need to be searchers for truth. I wrote on my blog back in April 2018, did Assad really gas people on April 7th, 2018? Or could this be a false flag? If we don't like those questions, then we do not need alternative media. We turn on our televisions, eat our salty chips, and watch the wars of aggression and human suffering escalate while the mainstream media reads the cue cards and cheers it on. One might make the modest case that it would be good for us to hear an alternative point of view, especially when so much is at stake. Banning and censoring are only done when those who ban and censor have something to hide, and when the facts call into question the narrative provided by those who control the media. Banning and censoring are not done by those who seek truth. Those who seek truth welcome debate. They welcome a variety of points of view, and they say, let's discuss this. Present your case. I'll present mine. Alternative media, such as community radio, KBOO, should be a place that provides this platform. Dr. Kevin Barrett is an expert in helping us understand false flags. We need his point of view, not because I think his view is the absolute truth, agree or disagree with him. He has important information to share, An open sharing of information and a lively debate about it is the heart of a democracy. You can catch Kevin Barrett's important program, False Flag Weekly News, and Truth Jihad Radio. Both shows are on the internet. His audio and articles and books at truthjihad.com. My guest this morning, I first heard on Dr. Kevin Barrett's show. Had it not been for Dr. Barrett, I would not have heard of Hugh Turley, and I would not have heard of the martyrdom of Thomas Merton. Hugh Turley is with me from Maryland. Are you there, Hugh?
Yes, I am. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for waiting with me a few minutes, and glad to have you with me. Hugh was on a few months ago to talk about the book, The Martyrdom of Thomas Merton. Hugh and David Martin co-wrote this book, and the website is themartyrdomofthomasmerton.com. And we're going to talk, focus mostly on the response that you've received by various entities to this book. But first of all, There are a couple of stories about it. There's an official story, and then there's a popular story about his death, one by accident, one by heart attack, on December 10th, 1968, when he was at a conference in Bangkok, Thailand. Thomas Merton, for those of you who don't know, a spiritual leader and writer, a very prolific writer, very important thinker in the 20th century. So, you make the case, though, that his death was not an accident or a heart attack, but foul play. What are the major pieces of evidence that you've discovered that lead you to that conclusion?
Well, the evidence is pretty overwhelming that there's been a cover-up, and it started right at the beginning. To clarify some things, the official cause of death is what the officials determined in Thailand. And there were several reports. There was a doctor's report, a death certificate, and there was even a report from the U.S. Embassy. And they concluded that his death was caused by sudden heart failure. Nothing about an accident.
Okay.
And the police had reported in their report that Merton had a heart failure and then collided with a fan after he was dead. It said that he came in, so he didn't get electrocuted and then die. A lot of people like to say, well, the electrocution caused the heart attack. Well, he was dead before he came in contact with the fan, according to the officials. Now, that's the official story, was that he was dead before he came in contact with the fan, and that his cause of death, the cause officially, was sudden heart failure. Now, the popular story, and it's sometimes called the traditional narrative or the standard account, it has several different names, but the other one is called the widely accepted. And those are some terms that have never been defined. And there are, I have on our website, we've listed about 50 different accounts. And they range from a hairdryer fell into his bathtub, a radio fell in the bathtub, a fan fell in the bathtub. He was in a bathtub and slipped and grabbed a fan. He was in a shower, slipped and grabbed a fan, or stepped out of the shower, slipped on the tiled floor, and so on and so forth. And they're really endless. People sort of come up with their own idea of how they think he might have died, and they write it up. Remember one person said he died on December 5th, which in fact he died on December 10th. But the facts don't really matter to these scholars. And I'm talking about people that are college professors and academics and authors and some very well-known people. I'll give you one example is Lawrence Cunningham. He's a professor at Notre Dame emeritus, very distinguished fellow. He wrote that Merton took a shower around 1:30 in the afternoon and in an attempt to move a large fan was electrocuted. The facts seem to be more straightforward. He died either from the electrocution directly or from a heart attack precipitated by the shock. Now, a couple things are wrong with his account. First of all, Merton did not take a shower or a bath. Witnesses at the scene said he did not take a shower. And there was no bathtub, so we know he didn't take a bath. But Professor Cunningham says the electrocution may have caused the heart attack. And this is where, again, being specific about what we're talking about is important. Most people don't know the difference between a heart attack and sudden heart failure. And there's a big difference. Sudden heart failure, which is on the death certificate, is electronic. It's like when your heart isn't beating properly. That's called sudden heart failure when you die from that cause. A heart attack, on the other hand, is because of a clogging of the arteries in the heart with cholesterol and so on. But a fan, an electrocution, does not cause clogged arteries. And Professor Cunningham doesn't know the difference. So when he says that the electrocution caused a heart attack, he's absolutely wrong about that. No one ever gets a heart attack from getting a shock. You don't shock yourself plugging in a lamp and then go into clogged arteries from that. It just doesn't happen. So that's the popular cause is sort of all over the board. But basically it sums down into what was written by Michael Mott, the lead biographer. He pretty much said that, and of course Mott even wrote that he had a heart attack caused by electrocution. He's wrong about that as well. But Mott also went with the shower story. And the whole shower story really didn't originate until 1973, almost 5 years after Merton died. And then it became the shower bath, became the accepted standard account. And it's any way you want to tell it.
So the official account done by the officials in Thailand was that it was heart failure. How did they come to that conclusion? Is there any?
Well, that's a good question, because they didn't do an autopsy. And there was also a bleeding wound on the back of Merton's head that was seen by the witnesses, including one that was a medical doctor at the scene. There was a nun. So we don't know what caused the bleeding head wound. We don't know what caused his death. The people that wrote sudden heart failure told the witnesses that we're going to call it sudden heart failure for convenience. They said, because they didn't want any, you know, problems for lawsuits or whatever with the Red Cross Center where he died. So he just said, well, this will be for convenience, we'll call it heart failure. So there was no real investigation of the cause of his death, but they just went with that. And cause never actually made it out of Thailand. It was reported like that in the Thai newspapers that he died of sudden heart failure. But in this country, from the very beginning, they've been calling it an accidental electrocution from the very beginning. And that's not true.
And you have access to actually a photograph of his body. Can you talk about that?
That's important too. Yes. Yeah, so there were two photographs taken by the monks that found the body, and the reason they took the photographs was that the scene looked suspicious to them. They thought, this doesn't look right. We better photograph it so we can show the police how we found him. And before they touched anything, they took pictures. They took two pictures, and they disappeared. And Michael Mott, in his biography, rearranged the chronology of events to make it appear that these photographs were taken after the scene had been disturbed. So people haven't paid any attention to these photographs, and then they were lost for about 48 years until I found them up at Columbia University in the papers of John Howard Griffin. And that they're very telling, because these photographs are clearly not someone who had an accidental electrocution. He's lying on the floor, and he's straight as a board with his hands at his sides, and the fan is lying on top of him. It's as if it's just been placed there. It's like it's arranged. One of the witnesses actually said that he didn't think Merton could have been touching that fan and landed with his hands in the position they were found. And in addition to that, in the pictures, he's wearing his pajama shorts. And they, you know, they're short pajamas you wear in hot weather, but these are shorts that he's wearing, and no one takes a bath or a shower in their shorts. So when they went with the accidental electrocution with the shower, they had to get rid of those photographs, because they didn't want people to see that, well, that's not what happened. So they're very, very revealing.
So in addition to now the photographs, the head wound, some of the testimony perhaps, what would you say are other key items of evidence that show that it was neither an accident or simply heart failure or natural cause?
Well, the witnesses themselves were curious. They wanted an investigation, an expected investigation. Of course, when the Thai authorities came and simply ruled a sudden heart failure for convenience, and they said it was for convenience, they didn't tell them about the photographs. And they expected, some of them thought an autopsy would be done by the U.S. military, which came and took the body away, which is sort of unusual, not the norm. And then one of them wrote, the one that took the photographs, wrote to the Abbey at Gethsemane where Merton had lived and asked about the autopsy. What were the results of the autopsy? He wanted to know. And, of course, there was no autopsy. So these people wanted to know what killed him. They didn't know what killed him. They thought people would want to know. Normally, a family would want to know what happened to their loved one. But that's not the case with the Abbey of Gethsemane, unfortunately.
Well, let's talk more about that Abbey of Gethsemane. I'm going to mention to our engineer, I want to play an actuality here, so to speak. This is a recording that was given by Brother Patrick Hart on your voicemail. It's about 3 minutes long. We're gonna play it all in its entirety, but I'd like you to set this up for us. So who is Brother Patrick Hart, and what does this actuality about?
Well, Brother Patrick Hart was Merton's secretary, and he became Merton's secretary shortly before Merton died. And after Merton died, he became the person in charge of all of Merton's papers. And he would decide what was going to be published and so on, and the Merton journals, and he controlled all of the documents of Merton after he died. He was also became the spokesperson for the Abbey to tell people how Merton died. He was the official spokesperson on Merton's death. And he, from the beginning, had been giving false information. He told people on the day of Merton's death, he told one of the, it was former Abbot James Fox, he told him either he had a heart attack or and grabbed a fan, or he had been electrocuted by a faulty wire in a large fan, or he grabbed the fan and it fell on him, or maybe he said he was even fixing the fan. Imagine that, and grabbed a badly insulated wire. Now, Brother Patrick is telling Father Fox this on December 10th, the day Merton died. He's telling him all, you take your pick. Here's three different ways he could have died. Huh. Take your pick. Accidental electrocution. Now, this guy, later in 1973, originated the shower story. And Merton had taken a shower. He said, I've read the police documents, I read all the medical reports and the reports of the witnesses, and I'm here to tell you that Merton proceeded to take a shower when he returned to the cottage, and then he was electrocuted when he moved the fan. So he started the shower story, and that's what has been going on for almost 50 years, was the story of the bath and the shower originated by none other than Brother Patrick Hart, who just died, by the way, at the end of February, at the age of 93.
I'm speaking with Hugh Turley. He's the author of The Martyrdom of Thomas Merton, the website, themartyrdomofthomasmerton.com. Okay, so Brother Patrick Hart, so there is no previous record of a story of a shower scene or a bathtub or anything like that prior to 1973, 5 years after Merton's death. Is that right?
That is correct, and there's no evidence of any accident in Thailand, according to Thai authorities. The accident story came from Brother Patrick Hart. It came from the Abbey.
Okay. So now you called up and in doing your research on this book, and you got a hold of Patrick Hart. You left him a message, and then he left you a phone message. And
Actually, I wrote him a letter.
You wrote him a letter.
And I was told that he won't take visitors. He was elderly, and he didn't like to write much. So I wrote him a letter and said, I know you're busy, and it's difficult to write, perhaps. I said, if you'd like to, you can just call me. I gave him my phone number. And he did call me. And I didn't get the call, but I did get the voice message.
All right. We're going
to play. I asked him in my letter, I asked him to tell me, what evidence do you have that Thomas Merton took a shower? What evidence do you have? That's what I asked him.
Let's play that.
Hello? Mr. Turley? This is Brother Patrick Hart of the Abbey of Gethsemane. I received your letter of the 17th. 19th of May in regard to Thomas Merton's death. I didn't mention the Asian Journal that you have seen. And I have only... I'm rereading your letter to me, and I'll just comment on it. Your three questions. Can you tell me what evidence that exists that actually he took a shower? Well, actually, there was no direct evidence of anyone saying that, but it was Bangkok at noon. It was lunch, and it was very hot, and it was very steamy from all the reports we had received. So undoubtedly he had taken a shower before he was to come back and speak. return to college. You wrote after an attempt to have an autopsy performed, which proved unsuccessful, to international red tape, his body was flown back. That is true. It was the Abbot Flavian Dabba, Abbot Flavian Burns, who had been the new abbot and consulted the community, of course, and his peers here, we all felt it wasn't just the abbot, it was the whole community felt that it would be best. We wanted the body returned here. And the main reason was so we could have a funeral, a monastic funeral for Merchants. I think this is a prominent figure in our life all these years. And, then you asked them in number three, they asked for an autopsy withdrew. Well, then you see, the monks wanted him buried here. I think we wanted him buried here, yes. And he was.
And that's the end of the voicemail. The voicemail machine ended at 3 minutes. Right. But let's exegete this, so to speak. The big statement there is at the beginning when he talks about the shower, evidence for the shower.
He says there's no evidence of anybody saying that he took a shower. Just because it was hot over there, he thought he must have taken a shower.
And that's it.
That's all he has.
That's all he has.
And
And the meme.
He didn't really answer my other two questions, but that was the key. Was that see there, you know, he said he read these witness statements and the official reports. So he said, based on what I've read, he said Burton took a shower. But see, I've seen those documents. I've seen those witness accounts. Nobody said he took a shower, and he admits it now. Brother Patrick admits that what he wrote. And the interesting thing, when he wrote that, he sent a draft to John Moffat, who was staying in the cottage with Merton. And Moffat said, you can't say he took a shower. That's not true. You shouldn't say that. Patrick wrote it anyway, knowing that it was not true. He wrote something that was false. And that's just plain wrong. And it's been the mother of all these lies for years, where people just repeated it over and over.
And you have on your website, under the heading articles, I don't know, picture after picture, article after article, biographer after biographer, who repeats some form of this meme, I guess you could say, of a variety of showers and fans, and some even making the accusation that he was just rather klutzy.
Yeah, that was from two people said that. One was Brother Patrick Hart. Brother Patrick Hart said he was klutzy. In fact, Brother Patrick Hart told someone that we were surprised he didn't kill himself at the Hermitage at the Abbey. We thought he would have electrocuted himself there.
Huh.
And then John Sweeney, the editor of Paraclete Press, he wrote he was a klutz, and he accidentally electrocuted himself in a bathroom. Not a heroic death, to be sure. That's what John Sweeney wrote. Actually wrote that. It's disgraceful what these people have said about this man, blaming him for his own death and calling him a klutz. Brother Hart told Anthony Potovano, the professor and author, that Merton was unbelievably klutzy, he called him.
So the take of this is that they slandered his character to keep this fictional story alive. Is that what you'd say?
That's what I'd say. And then the sad thing is that the people who have been critical of our book have actually come to the defense of Brother Patrick Hart and said, oh, how can you say these things about Brother Patrick Hart? Well, I mean, he's in his own words. He says that there was no evidence from anywhere that he'd taken a shower. He admits it. So why is everybody repeating this shower story?
Hugh Turley is my guest. He's the author of The Martyrdom of Thomas Merton. We're going to come back. We're going to take a short break. We're going to come right back with Hugh Turley and talk about the reactions that you have had to your book by official establishment, Merton establishment, and others. This is The Beloved Community on KBOO. This is The Beloved Community on KBOO. I'm John Schock, Buffy St. Marie. He's a keeper of the fire. Keeping the fire of truth here is Hugh Turley, my guest on The Beloved Community. He, along with David Martin, have written The Martyrdom of Thomas Merton. The Martyrdom of Thomas Merton. Matthew Fox was on my show, a theologian. He comes right out and says the CIA did it. He talked to CIA agents. The last one he talked to admitted it, that the CIA had a whole bunch of money. And Merton was really ultimately an anti-war speaker, writer. He wrote and inspired people to oppose wars of aggression, among other things, and so felt to be a threat. And so there certainly is motivation for Thomas Merton to be in the eyes of the enemy of the CIA, so to speak. But we're going to talk right now with Hugh Turley about responses to your book. Since The Martyrdom of Thomas Merton was published last year, have you received any favorable reviews?
Oh, yes. We had several favorable reviews, beginning with a Merton symposium in Rome last summer to commemorate the 50th anniversary of Merton's death. We were invited to present a paper, and my co-author, David Martin, went to Rome, and the paper was an analysis of the story from Michael Mott, the lead biographer, official biographer of Merton's death, and really what's become the popular accepted account. And that was very important that we got to that conference, because it gave us some standing in an academic forum. And then Edward Curtin wrote a very nice review. Edward Curtin found out about our book from Jim Douglas. I don't know if you're familiar with him. He wrote
JFK.
JFK and the Unspeakable, right. And Curtin found out about our book from Douglas and wrote a very nice review. He said the book was meticulously researched and sourced and documented, and puts to shame the lie of so many other works, and especially academic ones, that they purport to be profound but fall apart when they're inspected. And that review got us a lot of interest. Also, another big supporter of ours has been Patrick Jameson, the editor of the Island Catholic News up in British Columbia.
Island Catholic News, right?
Island Catholic News. Okay. It's a great publication. He's an independent guy and a real truth seeker. And he was skeptical when he first heard of my book. He wanted to know about it, and he was curious. He was interested, but I sent him a copy, and he fell in love with it. He said, "I defy anyone to read this book and not have their understanding of the facts and meaning and political significance of Merton's death radically altered." And he's written an editorial about our book, and he's published some articles about the book, and he's got one coming up that's going to reprint our paper from the Rome conference from last summer. He's going to reprint that whole paper, and that's coming up in their next edition. And they are online, too. I think they're online, yeah.
All right. Well,
of course, Matthew Fox has been a supporter. Yep. We got a nice review from on the other side. There's some people on the left and some on the right. On the right wing is a publication called Culture Wars, and Jerome, someone's known by Jerry Bruin, is an attorney, and he's a career attorney, and he knows how to examine evidence, and he wrote a very favorable review of our book in Culture Wars. And let me tell you what he says toward the end of his. He said, "Turley and Martin doggedly track down documents, past interviews, witnesses, written accounts, and anything they can to obtain relevant circumstances of Merton's death, while trying to unravel the errors, confusion, and contradictions. Merton's biographers, Michael Mott and John Howard Griffin, received much of the author's venom, and deservedly so." Amen. I like that. Do you know John Smeltzer?
No. Tell me who John Smeltzer is.
He's an author, and he found a lot of artifacts of Merton's several years ago. He found a nun who had trunks full of clothing that was belonged to Merton. The Abbey threw them out, and they ended up in this nun's garage. And John found the artifacts. A lot of them went to the Merton Center down at Bellarmine. But he wrote, in the end, he said that you know, our book concludes Merton was assassinated, of course. And he says, "It's a revelation that has made many Merton scholars uncomfortable, even reluctant, to hear what Turley and Martin suggest." And that is so true.
Well, that's what I want to get to. What is this reluctance? So let's, first of all, start with the Abbey of Gethsemane. What has been the response from the Abbey?
Well, it's surprising. You know, when David Martin and I wrote this book, we we thought that certain people would be very interested. And of course, we thought the Abbey of Gethsemane would be interested. And we tried to go easy on the monks in the book. I mean, you can't go very easy on Brother Patrick Hart for what he did, or Abbot Flavian Burns. But, you know, we didn't want to blame everybody at the Abbey. We didn't think they were all, you know, involved in covering up the truth. And then, of course, it's 50 years later, so there's new people there. And we were careful not to say the Abbey this and the Abbey that, but we called it the Brother Patrick and Abbot Flavian, or the Abbey leadership at the time. But the response has been quite shocking, really. To start with, at their website, they still say accidental electrocution in Bangkok. And it's a narrative written by Brother Patrick Hart. And I've asked the abbot to change that. You know, you could just say he died in near Bangkok, period. They'll give a cause. But they don't even respond. They will not respond.
No response.
Now, the other thing that's very interesting is these documents that I found. I got them from Rembert Weakland, and I also found a number of documents at the National Archives. These are the death certificate, the doctor's certificate, and so on. And the official report of the embassy. These documents were mailed to the Abbey on December 27, 1968. And I thought, well, they must still have those copies. I mean, I can't imagine they throw them out. So I wondered if their copies looked like the copies I got. So I contacted the archivist down there, and he said they don't have them. They don't have the death certificate or doctor's certificate or reports. And they said that would be at the Merton Center. Well, I contacted the Merton Center, and they didn't have them either. So I sent them to the Merton Center, and Dr. Paul Pearson was delighted to get them. He said he'd never seen them before. And as an afterthought, I thought, well, you know, I should send them to the Abbey. They should have these. I thought, this is the 50th anniversary of his death last year. So I wrote to the archivist. I said, I'm enclosing these documents for you. These are the official records from Thailand. I thought the monks like to see them. You could put them on a bulletin board, perhaps. Well, he didn't respond. So I waited a month, and I wrote him another letter, and I said, you know, his name was Father Lawrence Morey. I said, Dear Father Lawrence, I said, I sent you some documents, and I didn't hear from you, and I just wanted to make sure that you received them. So please let me know if they've arrived. You know what he said? Nothing. He never answered me.
No answer.
And on the 50th anniversary of Merton's death last December, there were a lot of celebrations around the country at these Merton societies in New York, Chicago. They had events like the one in Rome, everywhere. They didn't have anything at the Abbey, not a mass, nothing. I mean, they didn't even mark the day of his death on the 50th anniversary.
Huh. Well, that is curious.
Isn't that strange?
That is strange.
That's
I found along so many Merton supporters. I mean, obvious Merton is just huge in the spiritual community, right? And other communities as well. But
let me tell you more about the Abbey.
Okay.
This is really interesting. They had an event in Chicago on December 7th, and there was a Franciscan named Richard Rohr.
Yeah.
From Albuquerque, New Mexico. Okay. Well, he was speaking at this event. And he told the audience about how he first saw Merton. He went to the Abbey when he was young. He had his parents driving by there. And he said he just happened to get there when Mother Teresa and Merton walked by right in front of him. He didn't know either one of them at the time, but he saw them walk by. He knew who Merton was, but not. He didn't know Mother Teresa at the time. But years later, he said that he went to the Abbey. He used to visit the Abbey. I think he was living in Ohio at the time, but he went down there. And he said he asked the monks if they ever got to meet Mother Teresa when she came. And this is what Rohr said. The monks answered, quote, "We never got to see her. Only the famous one got to see her." And then Rohr said there was a little resentment you could tell in their voices.
A little envy.
Yes. Now, that's the first example. Then he went on to say that he would go down there and they would concelebrate the Mass. This is when several priests say Mass together. And he said he was in the sacristy, and Dom James, who had been the previous abbot when Merton was there, James Fox, he was in there, and they were putting their vestments on. And I'm going to read you exactly what Richard Rohr said. He said, "I'm telling you this quote, it's not meant to be critical of Dom James, but he did say this to me. I swear it to heaven. He leaned over as he threw his chasuble over and said, 'To make Merton a hero, they made me into a Nero.'" interesting. And then, of course, Richard Rohr thought these things were amusing, so he's laughing, see?
Yeah.
Well, then he got to the last one I'm going to tell you is he said that he was invited to the Abbey to give a couple of retreats. And he thought, well, when you go to give a retreat, it's good to quote people. He thought, who would be better to quote at the Abbey of Gethsemane than Thomas Merton? So he said he quoted Merton during his talk, and he said that he had some grumbling and coughs. And he, Rohr cleared his throat to give the example. And he said the people, or the monks, rearranged their scapulars and shuffled their feet. And he said, I thought something else must have happened that I didn't see. But he said, a little later, I quoted Merton again. And he said, some of the monks were coughing again and shifting in their seats. And he said, you could tell that something was wrong. And they literally, he said, they turned their face, and two of the monks started to look out the window as if to say, we're not listening to you anymore. Now, these are Merton's brothers. And see, Richard Rohr thought they would be interested in hearing quotes from Merton, but apparently they weren't. And the whole scene kind of reminds me of, if you remember in the book of Genesis in the Bible, where the brothers of Joseph sell him into slavery. And these guys do not behave like you would expect them to behave. They didn't behave like Richard Rohr thought they would behave, and they haven't behaved like I thought they would behave. I thought they would welcome new information about Merton's death. But they are, well, one of them did write me a nice letter. I'll tell you, this guy, Brother Paul, wrote me a very nice letter, complimented the book and everything. And then when I asked him if I could quote him, he said, oh, no, don't quote me. And I asked him, why not? And he never would answer me. He would not answer the question. He sort of cut me off. At that point, he was done with me.
Hugh Turley is my guest. He's talking about his book, The Martyrdom of Thomas Merton, and the effects this book has had, the responses this book has had. We have about 15 minutes, Hugh, so I want to make sure I give you a chance to talk about all of these responses. What has been, we're just talking about the Abbey of Gethsemane, which is largely pretty much ignoring this evidence regarding his death. What about other Trappist monks? Merton was a Trappist.
That's true. Well, let me say one other thing about the Abbey before I leave there, is that the Abbey does have the book. I know that people have told me they've seen copies of it there, and I know some of the monks have read it, so it's not that they don't have it. I did hear from one monk at a monastery here in Virginia. There's a monastery across the Potomac from me called, it's called Holy Spirit, but anyway, there's a Brother Christopher Harmon there. And I bumped into him one day there, and he told me he read the book, and he said it was fabulous. He said you really nailed it down. He said, I think you've covered everything very well. He said it's very well researched. He said it's very impressive. So he's a Trappist, and he knew Abbot Flavian Burns, who was the abbot when Merton died. And Burns later went to the Abbey in Virginia, and he died and was buried there. So Brother Harmon probably knew Abbot Flavian, and what we wrote in the book about Abbot Flavian probably rang true. So that's what I heard from him. The only Trappist who really has been supportive was Brother Christopher Harmon. But I'll tell you another thing I did with the Abbey of Gethsemane. I offered to give them copies of the book to sell in their bookstore for free.
Uh-huh.
I said, you can keep all the profits. They didn't want it.
They didn't take you up on that.
All right. They didn't take me up on that.
All right. What about International Thomas Merton Society? I mean, there's a big thing. 45 chapters in the United States. What's their response?
We'd sell a lot of books to them. Yeah, they got 45 chapters. We thought we'd sell a lot of books to this group, but that was another surprise we got. This is International Thomas Merton Society, a group of Merton admirers, you'd think, and you'd think they want to know how he died, and there'd be some interest there, but not the case, actually. We submitted an article to be published in their Merton Annual, which they rejected. We also submitted a paper that we could present at their conference next summer in California, and they said no, thank you. And they wrote a very negative review of our book in their quarterly publication, saying that we were challenging the standard account. But they never defined what the standard account or why the accepted account is. You ask them, what does that mean? Well, nobody will answer you. They won't tell you what that means.
It's just
I offered myself to speak at any of these chapters. There's chapters near me in New York City, Pennsylvania. I joined the International Thomas Merton Society, and I'm a member of the Washington, D.C. chapter, And they said that they wanted to do something. Each chapter was supposed to do something to commemorate the 50th anniversary of Merton's death. So they were asking the membership, what should we do? And I said, well, I'll speak about it. I wrote a book about it. And they said, no, thank you. No, thank you. They did not want me to even speak to a little local chapter here in Washington. The only group here in Washington that had me speak was the Catholic Worker, Dorothy Day chapter in Washington. They were very receptive. I didn't mention them when I was talking about the positive reception, but the Dorothy Day Catholic Worker people have been supportive. Now, the New York City chapter of the Thomas Merton Society, on their website, still says that Merton took a shower and was electrocuted, and they refuse to correct this error. If you write to them and say that's wrong, you should take it down, they will ignore you. They're not going to change. They're going to keep that up there. They're sticking with the story and protecting Brother Patrick and his shower story, even when Brother Patrick says there's no evidence he took a shower.
Okay. Amazing. Well, what about Hugh Turley, martyrdomofthomasmerton.com is his website, and his book that came out last year on the 50th anniversary of the death of Thomas Merton. Accident is this meme with the shower, but the evidence, as you've uncovered it, is that's a cover-up at best. I want to get these other questions, but what can I titled this program, Did the CIA Murder Thomas Merton? What do you make of that? Is the CIA, who would you say? Who done it?
Well, I mean, they'd have to be, we don't really know who killed Thomas Merton and how he died because we don't have the investigative authority.
Uh-huh.
But it's pretty clear that he didn't die by accidental electrocution. And it's also clear that there's a cover-up because on those Thai documents, they wrote that they did an autopsy when in fact they didn't. So those are falsified documents from the get-go. But the CIA was definitely in Thailand at the time. They had an operation over there, Phoenix, which was an assassination school, and they were assassinating people left and right. And they have a lot of influence over the American news media, which went with this accidental electrocution story from the beginning. So they'd have to be a suspect. I mean, CIA, they have the means. And, of course, the U.S. government took control of the body right away, and they'd have to be someone you'd suspect. Now, individuals, we don't know, but it wasn't just a mugging in the street.
Right. And of course, that Matthew Fox, from just his own personal testimony, suggesting that the CIA was it responsible. He's been suspicious all along. Unlike the traditional keepers of the door of whatever this is, it's hard for me to get a handle on why spiritual people who admire truth and Merton are saying no to questioning these accounts. But we've talked about the Abbey of Gethsemane. We've talked about the International Thomas Merton Society. What about the Bellarmine University, Louisville, the Thomas Merton Center?
Yeah, that's another interesting place. Now, they have a Merton Center there where they keep all of his documents. Now, Dr. Paul Pearson is the director there of the Merton Center, and he has been very helpful to me. From the very beginning, when I was doing my research, he was very supportive. And he was at the Rome conference where my co-author, David Martin, spoke. And he did not say at that conference when he spoke, he did not say that Merton died of accidental electrocution. And he has been quoted as saying that, the circumstances are really unknown how he died. And he's right about that. And his website says that Merton died in Bangkok, 1968, or near Bangkok. He doesn't give a cause, and he's right about that, because we don't know the exact cause of his death. We know there was a bleeding wound and there was no autopsy, and people have done their best to create false stories about it and made up stories about it and repeated these false stories. So it's very suspicious for sure. And of course, an unsolved homicide is still a homicide. It's always a homicide until you rule out other causes. And if it's a heart attack, we better dig him up and find the clogged arteries. otherwise, you don't have that.
Well, what you're saying is this is still open to an investigation. If someone were to open up an official investigation, it still could happen.
Oh yeah, but I don't think the Abbey's going to let you dig up that body. I mean,
yeah.
But a forensic pathologist could examine the back of that head and see, there's a reason why he had a bleeding head wound. I mean, was it from hitting the floor, or did hit with an ice pick? Was there a small caliber bullet wound in his head? I mean, what caused the bleeding head wound would be a primary question that a forensic pathologist would want to examine that head and see what's in the back of his head.
Let's take, let's take a few moments and talk about the big question, I think, behind all of these specific ones. What would you say, Hugh Turley, is the greatest obstacle to the truth about Merton's murder being more widely known?
Well, there's a couple of factors. One is people have a natural resistance to not know the truth about things. And, I mean, up at Penn State, Jerry Sandusky was molesting children and nobody wanted to hear about it. These kids would go to a school counselor, and the counselor would tell the kid, well, Jerry Sandusky has a heart of gold. He would never do that. And people don't want to know about things until it becomes acceptable. I told you the Merton Center at Bellarmine has been supportive, but the faculty has not been supportive. And one of the faculty members is Professor Gregory Hillis, a theology professor. And he wrote a very negative review of our book, but he did it on Twitter, which, if you can believe that, he stapled it all together. But you've read our book. I mean, he said, this is what he wrote. He said, it's not a work of serious scholarship. And this is the opposite of what people like Edward Curtin said. He said, which is to be expected from a book that's self-published and challenges the traditional narrative. I asked Professor Hillis, what is the traditional narrative? What do you mean by that term? He does not answer me. He won't answer me. But he says that to believe our theory, you have to suspect Brother Patrick Hart, who was a friend of his. Well, you know, Jerry Sandusky had friends too, and nobody wanted to believe it.
Yeah.
He says it's not believable. So, you know, in fact, he summed up his book review by saying, don't read this book. That's what Professor Hillis, his advice to people is, don't read this book. Well, you know, he doesn't want to know the truth. And some people just don't want to know it because it's uncomfortable. And I know, I live in near the Washington, D.C. area, and there's a Archbishop Cardinal McCarrick. I don't know if you heard about him. It was a big scandal. This guy was molesting seminarians. If you told that to people 5 years ago, they would have covered their ears and said, I want to hear it. But when the New York Times says it's going on, then it's open season. And if the New York Times reported tomorrow, did a book review of our book, it would be an overnight hit. But until the powers that be say it's okay, people avoid it. They're just afraid. And it's each individual person sort of has their own reluctance to know the truth. And that's the sad thing. I mean, it's not the news media so much or anything else than just people's, they prefer ignorance and where they can be safely ignorant. And that's they're comfortable being ignorant. That's the what I think my friend, the co-author, Gary, if I could share one of his poems with you.
Yeah, you got a poem from David, like, David Martin?
Got a poem from David Martin.
All right.
Too much knowledge about Thomas Merton's death. Could it be we've learned too much? If charged, we must confess. We would be more popular if we knew much less. When we knew what others knew, everything was great. Merton prose had not consigned us to a pariah state. Education's big with them, and ignorance the foe, except for those disturbing things that they don't want to know.
Yeah, there's a little limerick that tells some truth about truth, doesn't it? When truth is uncomfortable, when truth challenges our myths of innocence, we have a bad U.S. government, but they're not that bad. Or whatever it might be, or the myths of church or religious institutions or whatever they might be, we tend not to look. You know, I have read your book, and that's why I've had you on the show twice, because I feel it is critically important. In 1968, it was an important year. Assassinations there of Robert F. Kennedy, Martin Luther King, Thomas Merton, all in that same year, and all of those deaths suspicious. As new authors are pointing out. Well, let's look ahead. We got about 3 minutes here, Hugh Turley. What's next for where are you going next to get the word out?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, I've got a kind of busy myself at home. My wife is disabled, and I'm a 24-hour caregiver. But I am going out to Gethsemane at the end of this week. I'm actually going out. I wanted to speak to some of Gethsemane. I wanted to speak to some of the professors at the university. I want to meet Dr. Pearson, but everybody's too busy to talk to me. I'll probably get to talk to Dr. Pearson, but the faculty has all said that they don't have any desire to speak to me. And I contacted the student ministry and some of the student groups, told them I'd be willing to come and talk to them if they have a group of one or two, I don't care. But nobody has responded to me at Bellarmine, and I'm going to go to the Abbey. I want to meet some of these monks. But on the way, do you know I'm a professional magician?
Yes, I've heard that. I haven't seen you do your thing.
Well, don't get me confused. There's two of us. There's actually two Hugh Turleys that are magicians. One's in Florida, but I'm in Maryland. But Friday of this week, I'm going to Cincinnati because they actually want to hear me speak. I'm going to be speaking to a group of magicians and giving them a lecture on deception, which is my other specialty. It's kind of funny we're talking about truth, but I'm also good at deception, and that's why I'm good at finding the truth. But I'm going to be giving a talk to the magicians in Cincinnati on Friday. And then it's on to Louisville and to the Abbey of Gethsemane for me. I want to see the place in person, even if I'm not welcome.
Well, good for you. Hugh Turley, The Martyrdom of Thomas Merton, themartyrdomofthomasmerton.com is the website. You can go and see the evidence. You can see the official reports there, the documents. You can see all of this long list and with a photo of each person who's continued this official meme of the shower and fan story in some form or another. As a religious leader, a spiritual leader, I'm grateful to you for uncovering the truth about who I think is one of the most important thinkers of the 20th century, who talked about important things, and he faced, I think there's a case that he faced his demise for doing that, and that's not often said. A martyrdom, and that's the price people pay for telling the truth in our age.
You get time for one short one?
Got time. Yeah, we got about 50 seconds.
Okay, it's called, this is another poem from David Martin. It's a short one. It's called Groupthink. And this is another reason why people don't know the truth. Groupthink goes like this. He may now see the light, but his original stance is strong. Who wants to be dangerously right when he can be safely wrong?
There it is. We're going to end with that. Hugh Turley, The Martyrdom of Thomas Merton, themartyrdomofthomasmerton.com. Hugh and Dave, thank you both for your important work.
It's a pleasure.
This is The Beloved Community. It's an unusual time this month, but back in April, it will be back again, I believe, inshallah, on the second Friday at 9 a.m. on April 12th. I'm John Shuck. You can go to my website, progressivespirit.net, for more information. This is The Beloved Community. Have a great day.
I've been living to see you, dying to see you, but it shouldn't be like this. This was unexpected. What do I do now? Could we start again, please? I've been very hopeful so far. Now for the first time I think we're going wrong. Hurry up and tell me this is just a dream. Start again, please.
I think you've made your point now.
KBOO is looking for a grant writer to join our team. We are seeking someone with a proven track record in writing successful, complex proposals for diverse sources of grant funding. Previous experience working in the philanthropic landscape of the Portland metro area is preferred, and previous experiences working with community media organizations and with communities of color are A+. This is a 1-year contract position for a total of 200 hours at $25 an hour, and the grant writer will work closely with the KBOO development director. For more information, go to our website at kboo.fm. and click on the KBOO is hiring link on the right side of the home page.
And you are tuned to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM. It's time now for the Noontime Jamboree.
Yodel, hi, you're fiddle-de-dee-dee, all the songs of romance in the spring. I'd serenade a pony, but it won't mean matrimony, 'cause he can't buy a golden wedding ring. And there's a handsome cowboy that I know. I'd love to